Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer, and tonight we have three guests with us in studio, and we'll also be hearing from the Harris County District Attorney, Chuck Rosenthal. I just today went down and visited with the city council. They gave me the normal 3 minutes, and I'll tell you more about that a bit later as well. But, of course, from them there was absolutely no response. Steve, if you will, let's go ahead and get ready for that next track. Let's let the folks hear the beginning of my interview with Chuck Rosenthal. We'll be doing part two of this as the bulk of our show for next week. Are you ready, Steve?
All right, this morning we're at 1201 Franklin. We're in the offices of our district attorney, Charles Rosenthal. Good morning, sir.
Morning.
Yes, sir. If you...
By the way, Charles Rosenthal is also my dad's name. You can call me Chuck.
Oh, very good, sir. Thank you. Chuck, let me start this off. There's been some recent allegations of perjury. That was reported in the Chronicle. Ada Edwards has some concerns about the process, the procedures up to this point. And I understand that 2 days ago, Judge Crocker, I believe, put forth a ruling that not necessarily all-encompassing or whatever, still to be determined. And I was just wanting to get your response to that recent ruling from Judge Crocker.
Well, I understand what her response was. Her response was for a court of inquiry to determine whether or not Jim Boulding, who was the former director of the HPD laboratory, had committed perjury in a particular case, because the court reporter wrote down that he said that he had a doctorate in Bayou chemistry. I think the whole transcript reveals that when Mr. Boulding was questioned on cross-examination and was asked to go through his credentials again, he correctly stated that he had a bachelor's and a master's degree. I think what may have happened from my own experience in talking to Jim is that he may have said that he took some doctoral courses or took some courses toward a doctorate at the University of Texas, but I don't think he's ever indicated that he had a doctorate degree. We looked at it from the standpoint of this office. Two grand juries acting independently looked at it and didn't find there to be a crime there. And if there is in fact a court of inquiry held, I suppose that the same result will come out.
Very good, sir. As I told you when I first came in your office, I did some studying on the net, trying to look at, you know, different perspectives on this. And as I said, it depends on whether the defense attorney is presenting a set of facts or perhaps a district attorney. That there is some contention that, you know, drug tests, for instance, can be 75% right but 25% wrong, and that this leads to, you know, a lot of arrests and problems for people when later it's found not to be drugs. And then again, you see others who show that under proper procedures, proper chromatographs, if I'm pronouncing it right, and so forth, that it can be darn near 100%, 99.9. And I was wanting to get your response to all this brouhaha, if you will, from the press and others that indicate that perhaps we did it wrong in the past and that a lot of those cases should be reviewed.
Okay, well, just from a standpoint of policy, let me tell you how we do things here. If someone is charged with a drug offense in Harris County, and it's a felony drug offense, we don't take those cases to the grand jury until we have a drug report back on those drugs to make sure that, in fact, that they are the substance that we charge the individual with. As I understand, the way it's done in the Houston Police Department laboratory and the medical examiner's laboratory, and I believe Pasadena's laboratory, is there are tests run by two different scientists, and they have to come up with the same result for it to be held as a positive. There are some situations, and this really doesn't speak to your question at all, there are some situations where someone might plead guilty to a drug offense before it goes to the grand jury. In those cases, we still ask the laboratories to test the drugs. They don't have to do as definitive a test, but we still ask them to test the drugs to make sure they are, in fact, the drugs that we charge the individual with, so that if it's not, we can take corrective measures. If somebody bought turkey dope, for instance, and they thought they bought the real thing, they got arrested, they pled guilty, were on probation for something, and we found out that, in fact, it was not narcotics or a controlled substance, then we could make remedial measures.
Very good, sir. There was that, I'll call it a scandal, in Dallas where they had the sheetrock being used as evidence, and it showed that we do need to keep on our toes about these crime labs.
Yeah, and, you know, we've always followed that policy, though. I mean, that policy was in effect long before, I think long before I even started with this office, that we didn't take cases to the grand jury until we had a full report from the laboratories as to make sure that what drug it was.
All right, I promised you we have three guests in studio, and I'm really proud once again to have a Texas representative here to speak with us. We have Representative Harold Dutton. He's brought his associate, Nicole Bates, to discuss the subject of voters' rights, the fact that prisoners lose that right in many states permanently, and here in Texas they have to jump through a few hoops, or perhaps they don't. We'll learn more about that. And we also have with us Ralph Garcia from Unlock Your Vote. And I want to welcome all of you to Cultural Baggage.
Well, thank you. Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
It's Dean Becker.
Dean.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Dean.
Yes.
I don't know why I want to call you David. You just look like David. But, Dean, thank you for inviting me, and hello to all your listeners. I'm certainly glad to be back in the studio here to kind of share with your listeners some of the things that's going on in terms of legislature, and particularly as it relates to voting, and particularly as it relates to that group of voters who we've figured out how to keep them from voting.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you recall, but in 1997, under House Bill 1, at that time, a bill that I sponsored was passed and signed by the governor, who was George Bush at the time.
Yes.
That indicated that ex-felons who had completed their sentence, whether you completed it on probation or parole or confinement or any combination thereof, that the very next day after completing your sentence, you regained your right to vote. That was a rather quietly done, because as if you know the legislature, things that tend to make a lot of noise attract a lot of attention.
Yes.
And that was not one of those measures that we wanted to attract a lot of attention. But since that time, we've been sort of beating the bushes trying to make sure that ex-felons know about this law. Because one of the things that we find more often is that they just simply, the people who are affected most by this, simply just don't know that it even exists. And so they're walking around and it's thinking that, well, I can't vote anymore, so I don't even care about it. When the fact is that today, under today's climate, ex-felons who have completed their sentence do regain their right to vote.
I learned about the number of those who are unaware of this. I did my own sampling, if you will. I was out collecting signatures for the Libertarian Party, and occasionally I would run into somebody who says, well, no, I'm an ex-felon, I can't vote.
Right.
And I had the chance to speak with them and say, well, are you off paper, et cetera, because am I not right, Mr. Garcia, that once you're off paper, that you, what do? Have to just re-register, or you automatically go back on the rolls?
Well, one thing we're learning is that we estimate that there's approximately 800,000 formerly incarcerated people in Texas. Another thing to add to that is we're also learning that there's a lot of formerly incarcerated that have come from other states and that are now here. And this law that Representative Dutton passed here is very important, because voting is what distinguishes us from everybody else in other governments.
Yeah, but now, Dennis, you do have to register. Now, I know some of these ex-felons have thought, well, okay, I'm not an ex-felon anymore, so automatically, what happens is you regain your right to vote. You regain your right to register to vote, because the only way you're going to ever get to vote is you got to register.
Yes.
And so the whole point for us in my office and the focus has been to try to make sure that they know of the right, and that at the same time we get them registered to vote.
Well, I think in this election season it's more important than ever that people get registered, that people go to the polls.
That's always the case. I mean, what we've found more recently and what we've certainly experienced more recently is that one vote matters.
Yes.
It matters all over the place because, as I said to a group of ex-felons, a group of ex-felons, or 10,000 ex-felons, as I said it, with shotguns are not nearly as powerful as 10,000 ex-felons with voter registration cards.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, because there are very few elections in Harris County that the margin of difference between winning and losing is 10,000.
Right.
And so what that means is that if you got all of the ex-felons who are eligible to vote on the voting rolls and then proceeded to get them to the polling place, they could dictate elections. They could decide who was the mayor. They could decide who was in every office that we elect.
Yeah. It is always a rather thin margin in most instances.
That's right. And that's why it's so important to get this message out to ex-felons that they do indeed have the right to register to vote and to go and vote. Because to the extent that, as I said to one of them also, to the extent that ex-felons begin to vote and to express some muscle in this voting arena, then they can do wonders for people who are still in the system. Not to mention, one of the other things which we found also as we were trying to register ex-felons is that many of the ex-felons' family members are not registered. And so while we were registering that ex-felon, we in many cases had an opportunity to register two, three, and four other people.
Right.
Who had been turned off by the system simply because of what happened to the loved one, to the uncle or the aunt or the dad or the brother or the cousin. And so it's not just a one-to-one kind of a thing. When we start registering ex-felons, we end up registering quite a number of people.
Indeed. You mentioned that thin little edge that decides most elections. Prime example, of course, is Florida in the 2000 election.
Absolutely.
And the fact that many, many people were prevented from voting by this same exclusion, which is, I guess, has not been remanded in Florida. Once you're barred from voting as being a felon, it's permanent in that state.
Well, that was the case in Texas at one time, too. That was the case in Texas up until a point in time, and I've forgotten the date, but there was a bill passed that ultimately change that to 7 years. Mickey Leland, who was not my immediate predecessor, but he preceded me in representing this district I represent now, he changed that seven to, I believe it was from seven to five. El Franco Lee, who then followed Mickey, who had the seat immediately prior to me, he changed it to two. It's 2 years that you had to wait before you could vote. And so I just kind of figured it was my turn.
Yes.
And let's eliminate the two.
Well, you bet.
And at some point, I hope what we'll do is eliminate the bar altogether. That if you have a felony conviction and you're out on the street, why shouldn't you still maintain your right to vote? It's interesting, though, when you look back at the history of states imposing this ban against voting based on ex-felons, it came about at a time when a lot of the voting rights were being expanded to include certain people who had not previously been included.
Right.
And it was after slavery. And so when they started all that difficulty, there was a huge outcry to figure out a way to restrict certain people's right to vote. And this was one of them, by saying that since you had committed a felony, then you couldn't vote again.
Right. And again, there's when you consider the vast majority of those receiving these sentences that go to the pen and get this record are
right.
Blacks and Hispanics.
Right.
And there has been many have said that this is a way to help manipulate that thin edge on the elections.
Well, that's why it's so important that if we're also being the ones to go in, we're certainly a larger group getting out.
Yes.
And so as we get out, my message is to all of them, who have completed their sentence, particularly the black and brown ex-felons, that they have a duty now. I mean, that duty is even heightened for them because they've been in the system. They know how the system works, and they know the system in many cases has been not only unfair, but sometimes the system is unjust itself. And so as a consequence, I think they have a higher duty to go out and register to vote And so I'm always asking ex-felons, not for them to get registered, but I want the ex-felons to help me find the other ex-felons so that we can get all of them registered to vote.
Right. Well, Mr. Garcia, we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, I want you to kind of give us a summary of your organization, what it is you can do to assist people, and we'll be back in just about a minute and a half.
This is America. You get to criticize the government in this country. You get to say, I think these guys are ridiculous. It's guaranteed in the very First Amendment to the Constitution. It's what this country was founded on. You get to do that by being an American. The fact that she brought up our movies means we don't want you to say whatever you want to say. This is not your America anymore. It's our America. Them putting Tommy Chong in jail for making Cheech and Chong movies means that you don't get to say that in America. We get to put you in jail for it.
I had a bad experience with drugs. It was that golden weekend between summer school and regular school.
Hey, home, I want to smoke some marijuana.
They say it's a gateway drug.
Well, well, if it isn't the Doobie Brothers. Uh-oh, crotch the weed, man. Smell any drugs, Sergeant Scraps?
For me, the 60s ended that day in 1978.
What if God?
It's time to play Name That Drug by its Side Effects. Yellow eyes, vomiting. Black, tarry stools. Cloudy urine, fever with chills. Sores, ulcers, or white spots on lips and mouth. Unusual bleeding. Time's up. The answer, another FDA-approved product, acetaminophen.
Okay, I hope you were able to name that drug by its side effects. It's quick, but you can do it if you try. Okay, once again, I want to remind you, you're listening to Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war on the Drug Truth Network, Pacifica Radio. And our guests for this evening are Texas Representative Harold Dutton, his associate Nicole Bates. We'll have to hear something from you here in a bit, Nicole. And Ralph Garcia from Unlock Your Vote. Ralph, before the break, I ask you to tell us about your organization, what it is you do for the people getting out of prison.
Well, real briefly, what we're trying to do is here in Houston, Dallas, Austin, San Antonio, where you have the largest concentration of formerly incarcerated people, we're trying to go out into the street, to the bars, to the cantinas, to the soup kitchens, you know, even in some of the poorer neighborhoods, door to door, to identify these people and to get them registered to vote. Now, it's not just that simple. It's a lot more complicated because, for example, with the younger minorities, black and Hispanic, you know, to them it's kind of a prison. The system has been almost a routine where, like, you're in 6 months, you're out 6 months, you know. And then the police kind of have targeted these people easily. They know where they live. They know where they're at. And, you know, and they and sometimes you might say sit around the corner and wait for them to leave their property, knowing they're, you know, they may be, for example, having a barbecue and they're running to the store or back, and, you know, and they'll kind of sit there and wait for them. So, you know, we're encountering those kinds of things. And again, the Unlock Your Vote effort involves a lot of people in a lot of cities, especially Houston, because the larger percentage of formerly incarcerated end up coming here, primarily because Huntsville is the main system, and then they come here looking for work.
Yeah, it's all setting them up at the Quickie Mart. There's so many ways that we, you know, set the web to catch these people again, send them back through the same cycle. Nicole, when I first tried to reach Representative Dutton, it was you that I spoke to first. Do you hear people complaining about this drug war or the lack of rights that this drug war you know, enables the cops to go after people for little or no reason? Do you get any calls in that regard?
Sure. At the office, we get several.
yes?
Calls to that effect, yes.
Yeah, it's starting to strike me as my phrase, what the hell is it going to take? I mean, we have police corruption, we have, you know, scandals at crime labs across the state. We have a broken system of justice, certainly at least in regards to the drug war. I can't find anyone anywhere who will stand in defense of more drug war. It's impossible. And
well,
go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we started in this, and it started to build really in the 70s, and it sort of culminated into the 90s when we started to build all these prisons.
Yes.
Where what people did was got afraid, and the first thing we did is made people afraid of people who were committing crimes. And then what we did is we set about creating the kind of process where everybody who was running for office ran on the basis that they were totally against crime. Well, I don't know how you'd be for crime and run for office, but everybody's whole deal was, I'm going to be tough on crime. Nobody thought about being smart on crime until later in life. Now we've reached the point where, as one of the judges said, you know, people are stupid. They're going to continue to use drugs. He said, but you know, I'm stupid if I keep trying to put them in prison. I'm stupid. What I ought to do is figure out some way to get them to divert from the system so that we can do some kind of rehabilitation to address what their problems are, because all I'm doing is holding them for a while, and then they get back out, then they use drugs, then we put them back in, then they get back out, then they use drugs, and we put them back in, and this just goes on ad infinitum until the point where, wait a minute, how many resources do we have to waste before we finally figure out that, wait a minute, the best way to treat a drug problem is not as a criminal offense, but as a medical problem.
As indeed it is. I went before, as I said, before the city council, and I talked about some of the things that my interview had gleaned from District Attorney Rosenthal. And one of the things he told me is that, you know, coincides with what you were just saying. You cannot force people to quit drugs.
Right.
And it's just not going to happen. And perhaps there is a better way, but people, as you say, they don't want to appear soft on crime. Therefore, they continue doing what
Absolutely.
They're doing.
I had a bill during the last session that would have sort of decriminalized marijuana possession, for example. Right now, where if you have up to 4 ounces, it says it's a Class B misdemeanor.
Right.
And so I was going to hasten that and said up to 2 ounces would be a Class C misdemeanor. So anything over 2 ounces would be a Class... And it was interesting that that some people, and some of my Republican friends, by the way, said, Harold, well, that makes sense to us. When I started to explain, look, here's what's happening. You know, you get found with one seed, one roach in the car. Well, you get the same punishment as somebody who has 4 ounces.
Right.
Well, that doesn't make sense.
No.
That doesn't make sense at all. Not that any of it makes any sense.
Right.
But as long as we're going to do it by volume, we certainly ought to, at least the less of the volume ought to be the less of the penalty. And so my idea was, let's just make it fix it so that for a minor possession of marijuana, then we could go and get a traffic ticket.
Sure.
The other thing we did is, had a bill also that the Ministers Against Crime came up to support in Austin, whereby what we're going to do is, we're going to fix it so that possession of the minor quantities of these controlled substances would not result in a prison sentence, but would cause you to have to go and get some sort of a drug treatment. For Texas, that would have meant sort of a diversion of about 5,800 and some odd people away from TDCJ. That could have represented a significant savings to the budget for the state of Texas. Not only that, when you calculate it based on something other than just dollar cost, you quickly realize that you're helping save lives, too, because once the people go into prison, it is a huge problem. Not to mention that the people who usually go to prison are the people of color, the black and the brown folks.
Yes.
I mean...
70-80%.
Absolutely. But yes, by most estimates, these people do not represent 70-80% of the overall drug users.
Many studies have shown that it's pretty much across the board that blacks use at the
right.
same rate as whites.
Right, except that somehow or another, what you have to wonder is, how does this system figure out how to pick us up and drop us off at the prison more than does anybody else? Well, that's because all the resources are focused over there.
Yes.
I mean, if you wanted to focus the resources someplace else, then you might do that. Of course, I always have wondered about the efficacy of trying to have a program where you can find a $5 rock in a kid's pocket in on Lyons Avenue, but you can't find a ship with 5 tons of dope in it.
I mean, it's so true. I had a question, and y'all will get to hear it next week on the show, where I asked District Attorney Rosenthal, you know, isn't there some sort of racial bias involved? And he told me, well, the problem is those blacks using crack. And, of course, there's that disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, but it's where you focus your efforts.
Well, yeah, but, you know, crack didn't just come as crack. It started out as powdered cocaine.
So,
I'm not sure about the argument that people are trying to make, and to me it's a distinction without a difference. You know, that here's somebody using crack cocaine and somebody using powder cocaine. Well, where'd the powder cocaine come from?
Right.
Where'd the crack come from? Well, the crack came from the powder, but okay, well, where'd the powder come from?
Right.
Well, somebody brought the powdered cocaine in. They don't manufacture, when I last checked, in most of these poor communities, they don't manufacture cocaine. They don't grow any cocaine.
Right.
It always comes from someplace else.
Dean, I want to add that...
Sure. Ralph Garcia from Unlock Your Vote. Go ahead, Ralph.
I just want to add that I'm a formerly incarcerated. I've been off for like 10 months now. I went through 5 of the jails in a period of 3 months. And then one thing I learned is everybody that's in there knows who was the governor that when the law that came into effect that had them in jail.
Yeah.
Far as the key thing here is now we've got to follow through with education.
Well,
we need to get these people, these former incarcerated, to understand that by voting they can help change these laws that have put them there.
Well, you raise an interesting point, Mr. Garcia. One time I was trying to just demonstrate to folks why they ought to go vote, and so what I did is I went into the prisons to register those inmates who are eligible to vote, because the law says that if you're serving time for a conviction and that conviction is on appeal, you maintain your right to vote.
Right.
And so I decided that, well, okay, well, how do they get to vote? And everybody said, we don't know. I said, okay, I'll go in the prisons. And so I started on death row. Me and Mateen Baif, I don't know, you all may remember Mateen. He did a lot of stuff with prison rights. But I went in the prison, into death row, and we registered all the death row inmates who were eligible to vote.
Wonderful.
that's
some reaching out. It is,
yes.
Indeed. Steve tells me we're running out of time, and I once again want to thank you, Texas Representative Harold Dutton,
well,
his associate
you.
Nicole Bates. Thank you, sir. Ralph Garcia at unlockyourvote.org. Is that right, Ralph? Unlockyourvote.org. And if you wanted to call him here in town, his number is 713-807-7329. Once again, my friends, we're out of time. I thank you for joining us. And just remember, you know, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what you're buying out there on the streets. You don't know what's in that bag. And I advise you to please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of this.